says it's the end of time. And the Mississippi River, she's a gold grind. The interest is up and the stock market down, and you're only getting mugged if you go downtown. I live back in the woods, you see. My woman and the kids and the dogs and me. I got a shotgun, a rifle, and a four-wheel drive, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive.
Hey, 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 welcome to Self-Reliance Exposed, brought to you by Backwoods Home Magazine with Colorado Ron and Bubba Da Vinci. Colorado, how you doing this week?
Man, I'm doing good, doing good. How you been, buddy?
Dude, I'm like a little schoolboy on the first day of school. I am nervous.
Are you all giddy?
Not so much giddy, but more like scared out of my trousers.
Oh, come on now. Our guest isn't that bad.
Well, and everybody's probably going, okay, what did we just walk into? Obviously, there's some underlying joke here. This week, we have managed to land a interview that doesn't happen but once every 10 years. And why don't you tell them who that is, Colorado?
Well, we finally were able to convince Dave Duffy with Backwoods Home Magazine to do an interview. We're so excited. We're excited.
Dave Duffy, founder of The Feast. I mean, we're talking about 23 years of lore in this man's head.
Yes, yes. I mean, it's just incredible. I can't wait to pick his brain.
And here's the scary part for me, Colorado. Is Dave Duffy is a he's well first of all he's the editor in chief or actually his daughter's now the editor in chief
but
he was editor in chief of Backwoods Home Magazine, founder of Backwoods Home Magazine. He's an author and an editor for other books, and let me tell you, he is a perfectionist
when it comes to that. Yes, he is.
Well, I think something tells me that he's that way in all aspects of his life. But I've seen, you know, we have Doc Bones and Nurse Amy, who's part of our organization, and they submit articles to them. And I think I remember them making a comment that, you know, Dr. Bones, Joe Alton, you know, is a fairly prolific writer himself. You know, does a lot of writing and does and is a likes to edit. You know, does his own edits and is very good at it. And he even had red ink all over his paper from Dave Duffy.
That's right. I remember him saying that.
And every single time that we run into Dave, I get this like, you know, like a kid that walks into their, you know, English lit class for the first time, or they're waiting for their paper to come back. I'm always worried about what I'm going to say and have him stand up in front of the class and go, "All right, the way you say this is blank." That's a double negative, and you know, here we have an audience of thousands on a radio show, and I'm going to have a conversation with this man live, and I'm just
I'm waiting for him to say, "You didn't ask that question properly, so therefore I can't answer it."
Exactly. Something along those lines. And luckily, you know, he's a really nice guy, and I can't imagine him doing that. But you know, those are those little negative things that pop around in your head. It's like he's asked me to write an article, and I've basically have declined doing it over and over again, because you know, I can just see this big red mark all the way across the paper saying, you know, just one giant run-on sentence. Or, you know, did you go to school? Or just something. Anyway. Oh, man. And then who else do we have? Oh, so we have two really good guests today. And then on top of that, we have
Oliver Duffy.
Oliver Duffy. No relation.
No relation. Nope.
From Aquaponics USA. And,
yes.
And I know this is a big thing for both of us. We've both talked over the last 2 years about getting into aquaponics or trying it out. And so it'll be good to get Oliver on here and have some questions.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I wanted to jump in here and say, you know, look, guys, you guys have always emailed us and let us know what you guys liked. And the reason we actually even got Oliver Duffy on is because we've gotten several emails about how interested and how cool you thought the aquaponics setup was at the Self-Reliance Expo. So if you guys are listening and there's something you guys want to learn, feel free to shoot us an email. Go ahead and email us at what's a good email? Let's just do Ron, R-O-N, at selfreliancexpo.com. Shoot me an email there, and we will do our best to find one of those exhibitors that cover that topic and get them on.
Yeah, that sounds like a plan. All right, and then we will be playing our this week's Real Men of Genius towards the end of the show, and I think that's it. This is going to be a... the show is probably going to run a little long, folks, because you know we can't cut off these two guests because it's just great information. But we will be skipping Homestead Hunter this week, and we'll bring it to you next week, and maybe we'll bring you two if Colorado has time to look a couple extra up.
Yeah, sounds good.
All right. So, guys, we're going to do a really quick commercial break, and once we come back from that commercial break, we're going to go straight in live with Dave Duffy. Does that sound good to you, Colorado?
Let's do it. I'm excited.
All right, so we'll talk to you right after this commercial break.
Now, if we come back from the commercial and Bubba's gone, you know he chickened out.
All right. My door and my window are already open for the escape route. Okay, guys,
all right.
We'll talk to you in a sec.
If everything you eat comes out of boxes stored in your freezer, you might need the Self-Reliance Expo. If you're afraid to take out your own garbage because the neighbor kids might beat you up, you might need the Self-Reliance Expo.
Over 50 training classes are coming to the Self-Reliance Expo. This family-friendly event focuses on traditional values and long-forgotten skills. Gardening, alternative home building, off-grid living, food preservation, cooking with the sun, self-defense classes, canine demos, and more.
If you can kill a houseplant just by looking at it, you might need the Self-Reliance Expo.
The Self-Reliance Expo is fun for the whole family and is the largest of its kind in the nation. Learn how to do it yourself. Learn how to defend yourself. Save money. Save a life.
If the only screwdriver you own is made of orange juice and vodka, you might need the Self-Reliance Expo.
It's the Self-Reliance Expo, coming soon. Find out more by going to SelfRelianceExpo.com. That's SelfRelianceExpo.com.
All right, you're back with Colorado Ron and Bubba DaVinci on Self-Reliance Exposed, brought to you by Backwoods Home Magazine. All right, are you ready to do this call, Colorado?
I'm excited. Can you believe we talked Dave into doing this?
Something? I was thinking about it over the break, and I'm actually a little paranoid.
We may get fired?
We may get fired, and B, for those of you guys who haven't realized it from reading Backwoods Home Magazine or reading the website, Dave Duffy is kind of a perfectionist.
He is.
And I have the same fear of Dave Duffy as I did of, like, my English lit teachers. I'm always waiting for him to correct my grammar and whether it's – or my diction – yeah, and so we're going to be talking to him, and I'm just waiting to be corrected live on air. God forbid I ever write an article for the man, because all you'll see is red on the
red marks. That's exactly. I'm so terrible at writing to begin with. I'm afraid to send him anything.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. So all right, let's give Dave Duffy a call. Let's see what we can find out. So let's use the magic of the internet, and we will call him. All right, we're calling his private office here. Here we go.
You should have something clever to say when we call. Let's see. Let me think.
All right. Well, hopefully it'll ring here in a second.
Is it ringing? Technical difficulties? We're already fired. We're already fired.
I cannot believe this. This makes it a little bit scary. Is the first attempt we've already
he unplugged the phone.
Oh, there we go.
Backwoods Home Magazine. This is Rhoda. May I help you?
Hi, Rhoda. This is Colorado Ron and Bubba Da Vinci, and we're calling to talk to Dave Duffy.
He's right here. Just a moment, please.
Thank you.
Hi, Scott. Hi, Ron. This is Dave.
Hey. How you doing?
Very good. How are you two?
We're doing fine. I don't think we're nearly as wet as you all are. You guys are getting a little bit of rain over there on the West Coast?
This is about our fourth rainstorm in a row. We have the rivers are not at flood stage, but we have a lot of flooding of creeks. We got a lot of water.
You know, I saw some pictures on Facebook there that somebody had posted up from your office, and man, it looked pretty deep to me.
Yeah, Jeff posted them. Jeff Ferguson. This happens every year, though. When we have you have big storms on the East Coast, you give them names. We have storms here all the time with 80 mile per hour winds, 5, 6, 7 inches of rain. It's just expected. They got no names and they got no mention in the national media.
Wow!
But now you live on the actual coast, right? We were there about a year ago, and it's beautiful. But most people don't realize where Backwoods Home Magazine is. You're right there on the Oregon coast.
Right. Our office is located a street across from the coast. We got big wide beaches, several hundred yards wide. But we're in the town of Gold Beach, Oregon. It's an extreme southern Oregon, second town up from the California border.
Yeah, and I'm hoping to get back there next year and try some of that fantastic steelhead and salmon fishing you were talking about.
We have 4 runs a year here on salmon. We're perched on the edge of the Rogue River, one of the great rivers of the Northwest, and we have 4 regular salmon runs here a year. The town is essentially a tourist economy, and fishing is probably our biggest tourist industry. People come from all over the world to catch anywhere from a 20 to 55 pound salmon out of our river.
That's amazing. So, Dave, you know, we've gone through this, and when we were doing the show live, when we'd have listeners call in, you know, one of the questions we probably got most often is, how did Backwoods Home Magazine start?
I had been working at a regular job, like so many people, in my case, for the Department of Defense, writing technical manuals on how to launch cruise missiles. Yeah, for the Navy, you know, board ship, harpoon, tomahawk, everything you've seen in the 2 Iraqi wars. And there was a lot of money in those days. It was just after Reagan and first Bush was in, so there's lots and lots of money, a lot of jobs to be had, and I was making a good salary. But most of the money, even though we did some good stuff there as far as making America putting a good defensive posture, essentially putting the old Soviet Union out of business with that Reagan military buildup. Like most 9-to-5 jobs, I was unhappy with the work, and you're wishing away the week, waiting for Friday. And I had kind of the golden handcuffs on. I was making too much money to quit, so I thought. But finally, I did quit. I got fed up. I went to the Oregon woods, and I tried to figure out how what I would do with my life. I made a promise to myself when I was in my 20s that I could look in the mirror when I was 50 and like who I saw. Well, at this time when I did this, I was 45 years old, and I didn't like who I saw, just wasting away my life. So I moved to the woods and started building a house. And after a couple of years, I realized, why don't I show other people what I've done? Just get out, drop out, build a house, grow a garden, and that's essentially the impetus for the magazine. I started writing a magazine. Hey, you want to do what I did? I'm much happier now. I don't have as much money, but I live in the woods, and I love it. I'm self-sufficient and everything. And the magazine subsequently became a way for me to make a living, too. It caught on after a couple of years, and the rest is history. That was 23 years ago.
Nice. You know, that's pretty amazing. The now, from 23 years ago, let's fast forward till now. You've got an issue coming out here, any day now, that's coming out. Can you tell us a little bit, give us a little sneak peek what's coming out?
Well, I write the editorial on every issue, and that's one of the key articles in this issue here. It's on preparedness. We all witnessed Superstorm Sandy.
Sandy,
that
yeah.
left a lot of people without food, without communication. Their houses have been blown away for the last couple of months. And we saw how government was really incapable of helping those people out. The politicians came in, they gave their speeches, they left, and now you're seeing more and more on the news. Nothing's been done. People there were caught unprepared. They somehow were expecting government to take care of them, and government has not. Same thing happened after Hurricane Katrina. So my editorial is about a preparedness plan, my personal preparedness plan, on how I am ready no matter what kind of catastrophe, whether it's another Superstorm Sandy or Hurricane Katrina or a man-made disaster. And mainly it consists of a couple of backpacks with necessary survival gear in it, and you keep it in the trunk of your car. And if anything happens, you're able to take care of yourself and whoever's with you. If you're at home and you have to leave your home because it's blown down in a storm, you take these couple of packs. They're in your car anyways. You jump in your car and you head to a safe place, and you got enough food, water, fire-making equipment, telephone, ability to charge your telephone. That was one of the biggest problems people had in New York. People
yeah,
had
that's
telephones,
what I
saw. No way to charge them. They couldn't get a hold of anybody. And so just simple, simple things you can do to be prepared for any disaster. So I outline my personal plan and a good deal of detail. Of course, it's adapted to my locale in the Pacific Northwest. So a few things you'd have to change if you lived in a drier area like the desert or in the Northeast, in a big city area. But you can take care of yourself. I don't know how many of these storms have to occur. And you see the awful stories on the newspaper and on television of people in desperate situations. They don't have water. They don't have any protection from the elements. And remember, it's winter back in New York. And you wonder, how can this happen? When all it really takes is a little tiny bit of preparation of a couple of backpacks in the trunk of your car that are there. You got light, you have water, food, warmth, everything you need. It's very simple to do, but people never seem to do it. My readers of my magazine do it. I'd be very surprised if there was a substantial percentage of Backwoods Home Magazine readers who are caught with their shorts down like they have been in New York and like they were in Louisiana after Hurricane Katrina.
You know, one of the saddest pictures I saw, Dave, and I agree with you 100%, was of people in Upper East Side Manhattan, you know, very affluent people, dumpster diving. I mean, they had like a photograph in the front of the New York Times of these people that were digging through dumpsters trying to find food and things like that, and they're in, you know, $2,000 jackets just because they didn't have enough food to last them a week inside in their pantries in their apartments.
They don't seem to see tomorrow, let alone a week from tomorrow. They don't seem to realize that things could change. You have storms coming. They're perpetually relying on government, because back there they're big believers in big government and how government will take care of them. And very few people seem to learn the lesson. When a catastrophe happens, no matter how rich you are, don't expect your government to come and rescue you. They're a big, cumbersome bureaucracy. They're incapable of doing this here. And people are still suffering after Hurricane Superstorm Sandy. You see it in the nightly news almost every other night. This Staten Island, they're still suffering there. And they're still looking to government. They're crying, why doesn't FEMA help me? Why doesn't somebody come here? And I'm thinking, what the hell are you talking about? Why didn't you prepare to take care of yourself?
Exactly. You know, that's kind of my thinking as well. But, you know, you guys get so
much
water.
And our whole message to our readership, by the way, is depend on no one for nothing, least of which never depend on government. Depend on yourself for everything. Make it your lifestyle. Everything from building your own home to growing your own garden to canning, everything. And if a catastrophe happens, take care of yourself. Be prepared for it. Have a plan A, a plan B, and a plan C. Don't expect somebody else to come to your rescue. You're your own keeper, and that's the best way it should be.
I really like that. You know, Dave, I got a question for you, because I've struggled with this one myself, and my wife and I have actually talked about this one for quite a while. And we get people that ask us this all the time and ask us our advice, and I honestly don't know. But on that note, on that comment you just made, you know, the average American lives in a neighborhood, and you know, does not own their own home in full. You know, everybody says I'm a homeowner, but you're not really a homeowner till you own the deed, in my opinion. But so we've got a lot of people that are in debt and mortgaging houses. If somebody had the opportunity that could sell their house and take a little bit of equity, say, you know, I don't know, $50,000 to $100,000 in equity out of their house and move somewhere and build their house from scratch, what would be your advice for something like that? Do you think that's a good idea in this time, in this economy, and the way things are going, or do you think they should stick it out?
Well, because a lot of people's houses are upside down now with the economy. Not too many people have much equity in their house because, you know, since late 2007, the housing market has imploded. That was a good idea once because you had some money in your house, but it's a hard dream for a lot of people. But what we have always suggested in the 23 years we've been in business for people to do is build your own house. Wood is forgiven. There are lots of how-to books out there. You don't have to have a big expensive $250,000 or $450,000 house built. I built my house for $10,000. That's money that's about 25 years old, so maybe it costs you $20,000 now. But you can build a house. I mean, around here, you can hire a local, a metal pole frame with a slab built that'll be about 1,000 square feet, built for $17,000. That gives you the beginnings of a house like there. And a lot of people in rural areas do something like that. They live in that for a while in a trailer. Lots of people throw away trailers that are perfectly good all the time. It's a good starter home. And then slowly build your own house. Give yourself a realistic 5 to 10 year plan. 1 year, build a foundation. Next year, maybe frame the house and put in the septic. And maybe the next year, you start doing the interior. And then, you know, after 10 years, you've got a house pretty much built. You don't have a big debt attached to it. And you know, you're right. Having a house, you know, you buy a house that's for $250,000 to $450,000. You don't really own it. You have a big debt. So why not build your own house? It's not that hard. You make mistakes. When I built my house, essentially a couple of years before the magazine, it's what launched the magazine. I really had no carpentry skills, but I had a lot of how-to books, and I made my mistakes, and I chronicled it all in the early issues of Backwoods Home Magazine. I made my mistakes. I rectified them. By the time it was done, I had a nice house. It cost me $10,000, but I had paid it as I went along. So I owed nothing on the house. So start small, and you know, gradually I've learned those carpentry skills. So I do home projects on my own home, and now I got a bigger house. But you don't have to go in debt for a lot of this stuff.
Now, when you talked about your early issues, you were writing the articles and chronicling the things that you were doing, but you know, now you have a this bevy of writers that cover a lot of those topics, and in almost every issue you have topics that talk about all the how-to things that you can do, from Jeff Yago to Jackie Clade. I mean, just the list goes on and on. How do you choose those people to become writers for you, and how do you choose the topics? Do they submit them to you, or do you have like a theme for an issue and then you kind of go from there?
Typically, now, you know, I started off by showing by my own example, and then I attracted people like Jackie Yago and Jeff Yago, you know, all these very good people who have their own particular disciplines. Typically, writers submit us articles. We have some regulars like those two you mentioned, Jeff and Jackie. And we have some writers who might only write for us once in their life or might write for us every couple of years. But typically we have a bunch of articles that have been submitted, and we, Annie and I, Annie's my daughter and the managing editor for the last 3 years, Annie and I have said, yeah, these work, these are pretty good. In about a month before the new issue, we'll look at what we have, and a theme sort of evolves. Not always. Sometimes we just have a magazine with no theme, but quite a bit of the time we have a magazine with a theme. The issue coming out, by the way, with, it probably hit the newsstand yesterday or it'll hit tomorrow. The theme is chickens, because we had a lot of terrific chicken articles, and so that became the theme. But we get articles from all over the place. We sometimes solicit articles from key writers. If we knew ahead of time this issue, the theme was going to be on chickens, we might have asked Jackie Clay to write an article on chickens. It just so happened she wrote one, and the theme happened to evolve. But we probably have, we have two file cabinets, 7 drawers full of writers. Yeah, each one has a manila envelope with a writer's past submissions over 23 years. So we have two filing cabinets full of writers who have written for us, a very wide diversity. But some, like Jeff and Jackie, write for us on a fairly regular basis. Masad Aoub, too, Linda Gabris, there's a variety who write for us on a fairly regular basis.
Now you mentioned Annie there. She said she was your daughter. So my question for you now is, I've never been able to do this, and so how is it running a family business? Because I've never had much luck trying to do anything with my bullheaded brothers, but they'll say the same thing about me, I'm sure. So I'm kind of curious, how are you able to have such a successful magazine and do all these things, and keep it all in the family?
It's a lot of fun. The most successful small businesses I've encountered in the 23 years I've been running Backwards Home Magazine have been these mom-and-pop family businesses where sometimes the children are involved, too. On your own self-reliance shows, which are marvelous shows everybody should go to, I would bet you 75% of the vendors at those shows are mom-and-pop family businesses. They're selling small products. Most of them are a little bit smaller than Backwards Home Magazine, but some, like the people selling freeze-dried food, are a little bit bigger than Backwards Home Magazine. And they involve the entire family. It's just a lot of fun. You can kind of depend on your family to do stuff. It may not work for a while, but I would say that's 75% of the vendors at your own shows. And in a small town like where I live in Gold Beach, I wouldn't be surprised if it's roughly the same proportion. About 75% of the stores, if you go up and down the streets of this town of 2000, 75% of those vendors are probably mom-and-pop businesses. They seem very successful. You almost have to be. If you're alone, you're the husband or the wife trying to run a business, it's hard to do it. But if you can share that business burden with one other person, in my case, my wife does the business half of my magazine, it relieves you tremendously. And you're seeing each other anyway. It's not like you're both off to work all day long, then you see each other at night. You're seeing each other all day long. You're sharing the problems. In the case of Annie comes in. By the time Annie's 6 years old, she's stuffing magazines into envelopes, to send to subscribers. By the time she's 7, she actually wrote her first little article for the magazine. And then she took over as managing editor 3 years ago. She's been groomed to take over the editorial side of the business all these years. But it's fun. You get to spend so much more time with your family. And you see a lot of happy children helping their mom and dad tend these booths at your self-reliance shows. I think it's a marvelous lifestyle.
Now, it's not just Annie, though. Your son also, and we've actually interviewed him, is participating, and he's kind of going the other direction, which is he's handling the tech side for you.
Yeah, one of my three sons, two of them are off in college now studying their own thing, and my youngest son, Sam, who's 17 years of age, put us on Kindle a year ago. He took a magazine. He's very computer savvy, as all these young kids are doing their all-night gaming and stuff like that. He took us, put us on the Kindle platform, and within a year, as of today, let's see, we have 5,108 Kindle subscribers, accomplished because the 17-year-old kid understands computers. And keep in mind, we're a magazine of fairly decent size, but fairly decent size, I'm talking 37,000 subscribers. In 1 year, he got 5,000 subscribers in a totally different world than we are in, the digital world. We're in the paper world. And so that's kind of fun, but, you know, he was brought up with the magazine. He understands the message, and he's working on getting us on the Apple newsstand now and on the where he got us in Barnes & Noble's Nook publication, and it works good. He's under the tutelage of my IT guy named Al Bowley, who I believe you interviewed last week. Just one of these very sharp IT guys who understands everything that's going on in the computer world. So he's been tutoring Sammy, and Sammy understands the magazine world, and it's a very successful combination.
And you know, I think you're probably picking up a brand new demographic that probably, I know that I'm finding that the younger generation doesn't read as much anymore, at least in paper form. My daughter's
You know what? You're absolutely right. I think I would say of our 5,000 Kindle subscribers, maybe 5 or 10% are our old print issue subscribers who converted over to Kindle. I would bet you 90 to 95% of them are brand new people who wouldn't have subscribed to us except they were cruising Amazon's worldwide network, and, you know, Amazon puts out the Kindle, and they said, oh, what's this? Something called Backwards Home Magazine. And they downloaded a free copy because, you know, when the Kindle subscribers, you get to download whatever magazine you want free for 30 days, and then if you like it, you subscribe. So I think these are mainly new subscribers that Amazon has found for us. It's an entirely different world for publishing, and all magazines, all newspapers are going to have to get on the same, you know, bandwagon we have gotten on is this world of digital publishing. I don't think print is going to go away, at least not in my lifetime, but it's going to transition to a digital world, and maybe within the next 10 or 20 years there'll be this hybrid combination that you get a print issue of the magazine, but you get some digital, because in digital, if I have a Jackie Clay article, say, planting a garden in my print issues, and then you can go on the digital issue online, whether it's on Kindle or some website, and all of a sudden you can touch a picture with Jackie Clay in it, and she begins walking and talking and showing you how to plant a garden. That's an entirely different experience. And that's what I think is coming down the line. We are certainly working at that. I just talked to Jackie yesterday, and I told her, send me the camera we sent you 2 years ago. We're going to take you, wire you for sound and video. We're going to get you a remote microphone, so the quality will be good. We're going to get you a tripod, but we're going to test it all out here. And we have plans to make Jackie walk and talk in our digital issue. And I would say that's going to be accomplished probably within the next 6 months to a year.
Wow, that is really amazing. I can't wait for that. That's going to be pretty exciting. Now, one of the questions I have, you know, you talked about, you know, you've mentioned Jackie and a few others. And you know, first and foremost, you guys, you know, publish a lot of material. I'm sure you guys get questions all the time as far as how to get published or how to submit an article for the magazine, or maybe somebody has a book they're working on, and how do they go about getting that published? I mean, are there certain guidelines that people need to follow in order to maybe have that happen?
Publishing is getting easier and easier these days thanks to Amazon's print on demand. John Silvera has written a trilogy science fiction novel about it's an Ice Age adventure, essentially. He just put it up on Amazon within the last few days with the help of my 17-year-old son, Sam. So it's easier and easier to get published. It all comes down to the same thing, though. You must have quality. Even though it's easier and easier to get published, and you can go online and there's lots of help books on that, if you do not have quality, it's not going to sell. If you do have quality, it will sell, especially in this age of the Internet. The Internet allows the good stuff to rise to the top like cream, and it permits the garbage to sink to the bottom, you know, like pieces of lead. The Internet is where everybody gets to vote on what is good and what is bad. It's a vast audience. Publishing is no longer controlled by a tiny group of very powerful publishers who decide we're going to print 500,000 copies of this book here by this famous writer. Now anybody can put a video, a book, anything online. It could go viral. You could become famous overnight. But it all comes down to if you have something that's worth saying, then it has a much better chance of being accepted by the public and doing well. I've predicted for about 10 years that the Internet is going to be the day where Backwoods Home Magazine really explodes onto the scene because everything becomes equal. People are going to read Backwoods Home Magazine, you know, especially a free copy like on Kindle, and say, wow, look at this. And they're going to read some of the crap that's out there and say, what a piece of crap. And we are thriving in the Internet environment. We have a big recession in the country. You wouldn't know it at Backwoods Home Magazine. We are doing extremely well. A lot of that's due to the Internet.
Wow, that's great. You know, and you're absolutely right. It really does come down to content. If somebody really likes it, they're going to tell a friend anyway. You know, and if they don't,
you know, the way we grow more than anything, we take about 40 orders a day online right now because it's the Christmas season, up from about maybe 15 to 20 a day. And on each order, at the end, we ask people, "What brought you here today to buy this?" You know, whatever, it's a book or a subscription. And most of the responses we get is a friend told me about you. They could click on, we got about 30 responses they could click on. We heard you on a radio show. We got a letter in the mail. We saw you on the newsstand. But most of the responses, a friend told us about you. They saw
nice.
You online, got you on the newsstand, and they read it, and they told us about you. So they said, you need to go look.
Yeah, that's great. You know that, in that, since we're talking about that, you have an actual book that's coming out on a re-release. Am I right? That was written
yes,
by you.
My book I published 5 years ago, Can America Be Saved from Stupid People? It was called a bestseller here, sold 7,000 copies plus. I'm sure it's not a New York Times bestseller. So I it's mainly a collection of my columns, gleaned the best columns. So I added 23 new columns, 150 more pages, and I just reissued it. And it's a good book, I think. My editorials tend to be popular in the magazine. And it's about all kinds of different subjects, preparedness, a lot of libertarian philosophy, government, oppressive government, mainly about the media trends and freedom and self-reliance.
Now that book was also released on Kindle recently, correct?
It was released on Kindle about a month ago, and we gave people to do some free downloads, and immediately I think we had 7,000 people download it for free.
Wow,
that's pretty good.
When you put a book on Kindle, they allow you to promote it. Part of the promoting is you can have 5 days of free downloads for anybody in the world. And if they download it free, they like it. People tend to come back and buy either the Kindle version or buy the hardback book. So, you know, 7,000 free downloads, and mainly in this country, but Kindle is also in places like the United Kingdom and some other European countries. They just opened up in India. So it's good. It's doing well, and I think Kindle is opening up a different audience too.
Yeah, I would agree with that. So
by the way, we're going to do a little special for this issue. If you subscribe to Backwoods Home Magazine, which is $24.95. I'll send you an autographed copy of my book for free. Just have to pay the shipping. It was $4.95. We just weighed it the other day. It comes to about $5 by the envelope and the shipping. But subscribe to my magazine, and I'll send you a copy of my book for free. We sell it for $21.95, and you can have it for free. And I'll sign it. How's that?
That's awesome. Now,
nice.
And we've got the link. We have the link for that. And so Saturday morning, guys, when the show is running, we'll have that up not only on the website but on the Facebook page and everything else, so you guys can do that. It makes a great Christmas gift.
Right. And I'll have my webmaster, Oliver, do a special ordering page. So if people would like to do that, the magazine itself is the great gift, really. My book will just be extra. But it's a very good book. I'm pretty proud of it.
Yeah, and actually,
it's gotten a very good reviews. Just go on Kindle and read some of the reviews. I think one or two people didn't like it because I was a libertarian. Otherwise, everybody thought it was a very good book.
Yeah, actually, I really enjoyed it. Dave gave us a copy in Arizona.
Yep.
And I read it on the way home, and it was fantastic. So, Dave, what's next for? I mean, you're talking over 20 years that you've been doing this thing, and there's you have to have seen can definitely see in your head the evolution of what's happened with Backwoods Home Magazine. What do you see what do you see the next 5 years looking like? What's next for Backwoods Home?
A transition to a new magazine piece that has print and website interact somehow. I don't think anybody really knows how it's going to pan out. Most magazines and most newspapers are losing about 15 to 20% of their readership every year. It's been happening now for, it's got to be going on 10 years. And they're also losing 15 to 20% of their advertising. Most of them are not making it up by switching to digital only. The only ones who are really making any money on digital specialty publications like Wall Street Journal, well-researched business news, Consumer Reports, well-researched consumer news. And we're making some money, well-researched preparedness information. But most publications are falling by the wayside, and the fatality rate is tremendous. 15-20% failure among existing magazines a year. Just phenomenal. So we see us transitioning to the new beast. Even though we're doing well now, the main reason we're doing well is we've kind of taken the bull by the horns. We've gotten into Kindle. We've had an active website now almost longer than anybody, 15 years. It's longer than any other Self-Reliance magazine out there, and probably longer than just about any magazine. I guess we're closer to about, actually, you know what? We're about 21 years. Yeah, about 21 years on the website. That's longer than most magazines out there. So we have been doing that, and I see a continuation, actually an acceleration of that transition. I think there'll be a lot of interactive media, like I say, with Jackie walking and talking, and a lot more video. And there's a new beast being born on how to communicate information. And we're part of that revolution. Jeff Ferguson, I was talking to him the other day. He's my marketing guy. And I was saying, this time of transitioning the magazine into interactive media and the website is almost like giving birth to the magazine all over again. It's almost like I've gone in a time machine back 23 years. I'm in the woods building my house, and I'm trying to figure out how I make a living. And then it comes to me, I'll start a magazine. I'll show people how to build a house, how to grow a garden, how to be totally self-sufficient. What we're doing in the magazine within the past year is almost like rebirthing Backwoods Home Magazine. Everything seems to be happening so quickly. It's tremendously energizing for me, and it's just a marvelous time.
Well, I hope that, I think the one thing that's missing there, and it's kind of funny, the more things go digital, the more lost I think people are going to be. And I see a lot of the people we work with at the Self-Reliance Expo, trying to go more digital with their books, and I keep laughing because, my main living, as everybody knows that listens to the radio show, is video games, which is all digital. But because I live in a digital environment most of my life in my main career, I've realized probably more than most how fragile it is. I mean, I have lost days. As a matter of fact, Colorado Ron knows, just a couple, like 2 weeks ago, I was driving home from Michigan and my laptop fell out, and I couldn't work for 2 days. I lost every ounce of my data while my laptop was out. And if I
didn't you have a backup?
Well, I do back up my files and everything else as part of it, but backing up your files doesn't help you with all the programs. I mean, it's, you know, everything is on your computer, so you had to go. I had to luckily borrow my wife's computer, but you know, if your computer's out, then you got to go buy a new computer and put all those programs on again. It's time consuming.
Yeah, ours has backed up programs and everything through a thing called Dropbox, which just backed up. I type anything in, anything goes on. It's just backed up through the internet wirelessly through Dropbox, so we have no chance of losing anything.
Well, that's your data, Dave. I mean, Dropbox doesn't do applications. Applications sit on your hard drive. It only backs up.
Probably take us a total of an hour to load all our applications back. That's everything from Photoshop, InDesign to Excel. We probably got 15 different complicated programs.
Yeah, but if you're at your office, right? I mean, I was on the road. And so, but the point of it is that, you know, if I still believe that print is, you know, it might not work for the New York Times because, you know, those are newspaper articles, and I don't think people are as concerned about saving them. But I know when I met you, you know, the first thing I did is I bought all your back issues because you put them in the Chronicles together, you know. You know, all your issues back to number
anthologies,
one.
Right?
Yeah, anthologies. Thank you. And I find that a very good resource to go out there. So I think that what you're doing and Mother Earth News and things like, you know, a different self-reliance sort of magazine. I think people that are looking for that sort of thing, I think you'd be surprised at how many of them will read it in the digital. And I like having it in the digital form, but you want to have it in the hard copy form too, because if anything were to happen, paper is the only thing that's going to still be around.
You know, I agree with you there, and I prefer reading everything in the hard copy form. But I think it's kind of age sensitive. If you're in your 20s or even in your early 30s or younger, you're going more and more to digital. You're getting very comfortable with that entire universe. I'm 68. I've been forced to take my business to digital, but I find most people, if they're over somewhere around age 35, especially 40, you've got a big handicap when it comes to digital. You're just not used to it. You haven't really grown up with it enough. But the younger people sure are. They're very comfortable in a digital-only world.
Yeah. No,
but I'm like you, though. I prefer that hard copy. I like to sit in the toilet with my book.
I personally wouldn't have admitted that, but that's probably where I do 90% of my reading, too.
Oh, my goodness. Well, hey, Dave, you know, recently you were quoted in the New York Times. What did you think of that?
I thought that was terrific. I've been involved, you know, they wrote the article about the preparedness shows, especially the four preparedness shows, the self-reliance shows that you guys put on every year. But I've been involved with the old preparedness shows for ever since, the second or third year of the magazine. Normally, when a national media did a story on people who exhibited at the preparedness shows, it was a hit job. It was the show. We were a bunch of right-wing kooks, hate mongers, you know, just nasty, nasty stuff. This article in New York Times Magazine was even keeled. It showed that we're all family guys, that we essentially want to help people prepare for anything coming down the pike, whether it's an illness in the family or a storm or man-made disaster, anything. It was a very fair piece. And it was just great. They mentioned my magazine prominently. They mentioned your show prominently. I thought it was marvelous for the industry because I see the self-reliance industry, thanks in large part to the shows you guys put on, and it is growing tremendously. You know, it's the in thing now to be more self-reliant and more prepared than you're used to being. And so I thought that article was just great.
Well, thank you very much, and we're hoping that next year we can even push it to even a higher level.
Yeah, that would be great. You guys are doing a terrific shot. Remember when you guys started your self-reliant shows, I think I contacted you because I was glad to see somebody take the chance, because it costs a lot of money to put on the self-reliant shows, I know. And I offered you, I'll do whatever you help I can give you. I was so grateful somebody was willing to risk the capital to actually put on these shows. And now, how many years you've been putting them on now?
We're getting ready to go into our fourth year.
Yeah, so four shows a year. You've been successful. You're helping all the vendors. It's a great gathering place for the self-reliance community. We get lots of mail and lots of letters to our Facebook saying, put one on in my area. Put one on in my area. It's just marvelous. Yeah. Oh, it'd be nice if you guys could put one, you know, about 20 on. Yeah, but I realize they're extremely difficult to do. Anybody who, next time you put on a show, anybody who can possibly make it to it should. They're a terrific experience.
Well, maybe we'll try 20 one year, but that's the year that both Colorado and I both want to get divorced.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we'll have to wait a while for that. All right. Well, we need to get going here, but I wanted to give you one last opportunity. Is there any other suggestions you may have for possible Christmas gifts for your Backwoods Home Magazine listeners? I know you have a variety of books that you have out and things like that besides the subscription.
We have almost everything on sale. You can go to the website. Well, when you post this here Saturday, we'll have a link there, but we have almost everything in house on sale, as we always do on Christmas. We typically have 40 and 50% discounts on virtually everything in the house, everything from what we call our whole shebang, which is all anthologies and books we've ever published, which is about 30 of them, to a two-year subscription. Everything's on sale, and typically a 40, 50% discount. So there'll be a button right next to the show. People can press on that and they go right to it.
Yep, we'll have that show link up. So when you're listening to this show, just look right below in the show notes, and you'll be able to click that button and go out there and check out not only the magazine subscription and the free giveaway that Dave's doing for Can America Be Saved from Stupid People, but also a link to all the other books. So we're very excited about that offer, and hopefully you guys will give some knowledge this Christmas.
Very good. All right.
All right. Well, Dave, thank you very much. I know you don't do these very often. I think you said it was like 10 years ago was your last interview.
About every 10 years I do an interview. I'm not that comfortable doing this type of things. I prefer being kind of hidden behind my desk and my typewriter and taking a lot of time to think about what I want to say. I'm not that a spontaneous a guy.
Well, first of all, you just aged yourself because probably 50% of our listeners don't even know what a typewriter is.
I was going to say that.
See my computer. Isn't that funny? You know what's kind of funny about, when was it? I'm 68, so 30, 40, 50. About 40 years ago, I wrote a book called The Retirement Threat on an old Royal typewriter with the little glass windows on the side.
Oh, yeah.
I got it on my office here in our Gold Beach offices and our home headquarters. That's kind of funny, huh?
Yeah. Well, Dave. That,
yeah, that's right. What's a typewriter?
Yeah, exactly. That's what my daughters are going to ask. I can guarantee it. All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us. We greatly appreciate it, and we're looking forward to the issue coming out this week, and we wish you guys a very Merry Christmas out there at Backwoods Home.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
All right.
Take care, Dave.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hi, this is Jay Steven Stoller for Backwoods Home Magazine. If you like the program you're listening to right now, consider subscribing to Backwoods Home Magazine. Call 1-800-835-2418 or go to www.backwoodshome.com and click on the subscribe button. Every issue of Backwoods Home Magazine is over 100 pages, packed with solid self-reliance advice by experts who tell you how to survive in these unpredictable times. Call 1-800-835-2418.
Hey, 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 you're back with Self-Reliance Exposed with Bubba Da Vinci and Colorado Ron. How's it going, Colorado?
It's going good, man. You sound tired. What's up?
You know, it's not that I'm still kind of my mind's rolling from Dave Duffy. I mean, it's just, yeah, I'm sweating still from wondering what I was gonna, if he was going to give me an A or a B or what's going to go on. And I found it a very exciting interview. Man, got a lot of information from him.
I did. You know, and I hate to say this, but I'm going to go through his first anthology because that was him in there, and I'm going to do my best to try and convince my wife to build her own house.
That was a very cool topic.
Yeah.
But that was a good case in point. You know, I know the word anthology. I actually had two of them in front of me in case I wanted different topics. And there must have been at least two times during that meeting, that conversation, that I got tongue-tied, and I was like, and then he's like, you mean anthology? And I'm just like, oh, man, I hate talking to Dave Duffy.
No, he is awesome. I love it. You know, the fact that he is so knowledgeable about so many different subjects, and you know what's really cool about Dave is he has a perspective on this that I don't think anybody else has, and the reason why is because he has not only interviewed, but he reads every article that comes in, and, I mean, he's just a wealth of information, but he sees it from every point of view that you could possibly imagine. So when you're asking him, you know, his opinion, it is his opinion, but it's his opinion based upon, you know, 23 years of anthologies, basically. And so it's pretty interesting.
I mean, it's a bookshelf. I think there's I want to say it's like 18 or 19 books. But I could be wrong because I think year one was two books.
Year one and two were one book, and there's 16. I've got 16 books on my shelf. And I was going to ask him at the next Self-Reliance Expo if there's any more anthologies.
The last three came out. Actually, I think it was when we were in North Carolina, he brought them.
Oh, did he?
And I was going to buy them because he started advertising them right before our North Carolina show, but he's been sold out. He only brought like maybe a pack of, you know, 10, you know, 30 books, 10 copies of them for the Mesa, Arizona show. And halfway through day one, I think they were gone.
Yeah, so let's be a warning to everybody. I mean, you guys come to the expo, come early, because there's a lot of people that sell out, especially Dave Duffy's Homestead Basics. Backwoods Home. I'm sorry, I'm looking at a Homestead Basics website. Backwoods Homes magazines.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things about Dave is he likes to bring a lot of back issues. Yeah, because like me, since I started collecting, I started reading Backwoods Home, honestly, about January of 2000. No, that's wrong. December of 2010. And so I have December of 2010, all of 2011, all of 2012, and this weekend I'll get the first one of 2013. I'm so excited.
Nice.
And I'm so mad at tangent, but we'll go there in a second. They're collector's pieces. Although you're going to get the anthology later when the book comes out, I like having all the individual magazines.
Yes.
And, you know, there's a lot of people that come to the show, and Dave usually brings like a box of, you know, a dozen different years, and they always sell out. I think that that's kind of cool to have the original magazines.
Oh, I agree. I agree. It's awesome. And then you know, if you come to the show, sometimes the artist is there who does like all the covers, and he'll sign your cover of the magazine. So you got the artist, and he's been doing them since almost year one, I believe, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So all the covers of Backwoods Home are done by the same guy, and he'll be there. Sometimes he's there, so
yeah.
It's kind of cool.
Yeah, it is very cool. So that I already went down my own rabbit hole, before we go ahead and call and talk to our vendor, is we screwed up Colorado.
Uh-oh. What'd we do?
We started announcing in November our shows for next year. We have in April, we have Arlington, Texas announced.
Yep.
And then I believe it's in October.
October. Uh-huh.
We have Colorado announced.
Yep.
And
but we haven't announced it. You
well,
just did.
Oh. No, we announced it last week.
No.
Not officially, but we said we were looking at Colorado.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. But the main point I was trying to make was we forgot to send it in, so we didn't get into the first issue of Backwoods Home.
Uh-oh.
2013.
Are you kidding?
Well, no. We've been talking about it and kind of trying to get everything locked down, and I forgot just what he was saying, hey, well, our first issue for 2013 comes out this week, and I was like, oh, that's so cool. And I was like, oh, crap.
Oh no!
So we gotta get everybody on their stuff, and we gotta get them in for the February, before February, so we get all the other issues done.
Yes, yes. And what's nice about this though is we're done for the year. We set the schedule for the year. So once we get all the art created, we should be good for the whole year.
Yeah. All right, let's get back on track. now that I've taken the first rabbit hole, which scares me for the next interview. Okay, so guys, continuing on with our getting ready for Christmas and, keeping you up with the prepping news, Colorado Ron went and got one of our new vendors, and this is a vendor that came to our Mesa, Arizona show. But it's they handle a topic that I think is becoming huge in the not just the prepping community, but I think the green community in general, and that's aquaponics.
Oh, I love aquaponics.
Aquaponics scare me. I told them that at the show.
Really?
Yeah. It's expensive. I'm not talking overly expensive, but I mean it's still an expensive thing to get started on. Your footprint is not an investment in footprint size because you can get it done in a fairly small place. But, if I was still living in Texas, I'd be excited. Having moved up to Iowa where we suffer, 5 months of freezing temperatures.
Yes.
And I just think, because for me, aquaponics, the tilapia is both the what interests me the most but also scares me the most.
Well, I love the fact that you can have tilapia, have fish on hand, including your garden. So you've got your greens and then you also have the tilapia. I really like that aspect of it, but I agree with you 100%. I'm really nervous about pipes freezing or something going wrong, killing the fish, because it does take them quite a while to grow. When I asked him, I said, how long does it take to go from here to, from small to huge, and ready to eat? It was something like 6 to 8 months. I could be wrong, but I thought he said 6 to 8 months, which seems like a long time.
Right. And Oliver Duffy is one of the founders of Aquaponics USA.
And he's not related to Dave Duffy.
Not related to Dave Duffy. I was just going to make that comment. We have two Duffys this show. And let's go ahead and give him a call so we can get on here and we can ask these questions directly.
All right. Sounds good.
All right. So let's go technology. Now, hopefully this will go better than Dave's call. although it wasn't horrible, it's just I'm a little warmed up already, so I should be able to get this one even quicker. And let's see if Oliver picks up. You introduce us.
All right.
Aquaponics USA, this is Oliver.
Hey, Oliver, this is Colorado Ron and Bubba Da Vinci. How you doing?
Doing good. How are you today?
Doing pretty good. Hey, we wanted to call and pick your brain about this aquaponics. It seems to, honestly, we've gotten quite a few emails from some of our vendor or attendees from the Self-Reliance Expo in Mesa that we recently had. And
I remember that.
Yeah, you remember that? I guess it was a hit. So we wanted to call you and pick your brain on it.
Okay, I'm pickable.
All right. Well, first of all, for everybody out there, can you explain just the basics of what aquaponics is?
Aquaponics is a natural system that is taken from and technologized, or however you're going to say it. What it is the natural fertilization of plants by using fish waste. And what we've done is, and what many aquaponics farmers have done and evolved this over 20 years or more, actually this has been around for hundreds of years, but the technological side of it using pumps and closed systems have been probably a little over 20, 30 years old, is taking fish and growing them in some sort of fish tank of some type and pumping that water, which has the fish waste in it, into a growing area where the plants can use that fertilizer to grow. Of course, there is a third element in there, and that's the natural conversion using the bacteria in the system that converts the fish waste into plant nutrients. And then that water is, those fish waste are converted into plant nutrients, so plants absorb those nutrients, so water is returned to the fish waste, to the fish tanks, and in a cleaner condition than it was when it left, and this is a continuous recirculation. It's called a recirculating aquaculture system, or RAS, and we call it aquaponics.
Yeah, I like that word better. Aquaponics, that's a lot smoother. Okay, so now, one of the questions that we had, and, you know, we were discussing this earlier, is, you know what really attracted me, at least, to aquaponics was the fact that I could have my fish and I could also have my greens. How long does it take for a normal-sized tilapia or a small one to grow to something that's edible and ready for the plate?
Well, under the best conditions, and that I have to really put that there, under the best conditions, you can grow a tilapia to edible size in 8 months.
8 months, okay. All right, so you really have to kind of calculate this out so that once you got it to 8 months, you can pull a fish out of there on a regular basis. Am I right?
Right. Now, not all the fish grow exactly the same in a home system, because you usually have mixed sex and the males grow faster than the females, especially if they're carrying babies in their mouth they don't eat, and so they don't grow as fast. If you create a hybrid situation or a sex-forced situation where you have mostly males, and this can be either done through by breeding or through testosterone when they're young. We don't like that latter part, but the males will grow out very quickly and almost always grow the same equally, so they all mature at the same time, which becomes a little bit of a problem if you're just doing it for home use.
So basically, you NFL your fish. Right, you separate them off so all the boys are in the locker room, and you pump them up with steroids, and you can make them bigger.
I don't.
No, you don't.
But when they're very, very young, I mean days old or whatever. And again, I'm not an expert in that, and I haven't done that, so I don't know the exact how it's done. But yes, that's basically what you do, and because the sex is really not determined until they get a little bit older. And then they choose sex. The sexes then they split off.
Now, let me ask you a question. Is tilapia the only type of fish that you can use in an aquaponic system? I know it's an edible fish, but, I mean, what about, like, Japanese koi, if I just want pretty fish as opposed to edible fish?
Sure. Any kind of carp is a very good fish for aquaponics, and the reason is that in aquaponics you need enough fish density to produce enough fish waste to convert to have enough nutrients to grow plants, and not every fish likes to be in that kind of environment. Not all fish do well. Like trout, for example, really don't do well at all in that environment because they like really clean water and they can't tolerate much fish waste at all and this sort of thing, and take 2 years to grow. but people have raised perch. In Australia, they raise barramundi and Murray cod and, jade perch and some others, and do very well. They're much more sensitive. Tilapia are really, if you're going to have an edible fish, that's in the U.S., if they're legal in your area and you want to stay within the law, and some people do and some people don't, then that's the fish of choice. And there are different species of tilapia, and the laws vary depending on them, on where you are, because of the water temperature requirements. The colder water tilapia, like the blues and Niles, are banned in a lot of places like California, for example. The warmer water tilapia, like Mozambique's example in California, are legal throughout the state. a lot of misinformation about that out there. And there are other species that are in between that. But that's the best fish to raise because it's so tolerant of mistakes, of especially newbie aquaponic farmer mistakes. And there's a saying, you're not really an aquaponic farmer until you've killed a million fish.
So, oh,
we try to avoid that as best we can.
Well, you did pretty well because you transported to the expo. You transported fish all the way from California.
Right, large ones. Well, actually, some medium, some juveniles, and also some baby ones. So they were only a couple inches long.
Yeah, that was pretty impressive. So you managed to do that, and they were still alive at the end of the event.
Yes, didn't lose any.
Yeah, that was great. Now, you mentioned the cold water tilapia. The cold water tilapia, which would probably be the fish of choice for Bubba and myself because we're both in Colorado and Iowa. So is that right? We probably should stick to the cold water ones?
Right. Unless you're in a tropical – and even in Florida, they've been having some cold weather and having some serious problems. That's where we work with a hatchery down there, and they've had some serious problems trying to get their warm waters to reproduce and grow and such. So they've had to move their tanks inside and put heaters in them this year. And so we had some delays on some of the fish and still having some delays on some of the species, the warm water species. But, yes, the cold water ones, the blues especially, can live comfortably down to about 50 degrees. Again, being a cold-blooded animal, they don't grow very fast. They don't eat much and such. So you want to keep them up around 80 to really get them to grow. And if you want them to reproduce, you have to keep them in warm water because they won't reproduce in cold water.
So even the cold breed still needs warmer temperatures, just not as consistently.
No tilapia species grows faster in cold water than blues, and no tilapia species grows faster in warm water than Mozambiques. But the Mozambiques cannot handle cold water. They just die below about 70 degrees.
Wow.
So, yeah, the blues and the Niles are a little bit, they're also a cold water fish. They grow very rapidly in warm water. The blues, again, are the ones for the really cold water, and the Niles are, I'd say, next up the line. But we prefer the blues, but, again, there's legality issues here, and permits in some places are required and all this other stuff.
Okay, well, we've got covered fish now, and so we've got our fish, we've got our setup, and we'll get into costs and the type of setups people would typically use depending on the size of the family. What type of produce are we talking about growing in a system like this? I mean, is it in all the shows that I've ever gone to, including Mother Earth News and things like that, everybody always does lettuce breeds, which I'm assuming they just do that because it looks good and it's easy to transport. But
exactly. You can grow just about anything in an aquaponic system that'll grow on the ground. And there are some – we have – in our setup, we have a greenhouse, standard greenhouse, uses natural light, and we have an indoor system of the same size, which uses artificial light. If you want to grow in a greenhouse, and there's different kinds of grow beds, too, by the way, that are important here in this equation, you can grow just about anything. And you can seasonally adjust it just like you would anything else. Remember, the greenhouse has about a 30-degree rise in temperature in it, which in the summertime can be a problem. In the wintertime, you have a nice warm temperature here, but you have limited hours of sunlight. So most of your flowering plants don't – in our environment, we're at 3,500 feet altitude, but we're recently only 34-degree latitude, so we're not that far north. But – so we get, pretty good sunlight during the winter, but not nearly as much as the summer, of course. And we find that our flowering plants, like tomatoes and air vine plants and such, don't seem to do very well at all in the wintertime because it is colder out there. And in the summertime, they do very well. And then the leafy greens, like lettuce and basil and spinach and that sort of thing, cabbage and such, they do pretty well all year round as long as you don't let the leaves get too hot in the summertime. And of course, anytime the temperature's down, they grow a little slower. But on the indoor system, which is definitely temperature controlled, it's It's in the mid-70s up to 80 in the summer throughout the year, and we have grow lights going in there throughout the year. We grow mainly leafy greens in that because we're using fluorescent lights, and they don't have a lot of red in them, and even if they did, we couldn't raise them up high enough to grow. Leafy greens can grow under blue light, and flowering plants, when they flower, need red light. So because we're using fluorescents, we have to keep them very close down to the plants, just a foot or so above them. And they grow leafy greens grow very well under fluorescent lights.
Now, can I ask you, I've heard different stories from different people. At the show, I don't know if it's your wife or your partner, Grace?
Oh, Grace, yes.
Yeah. I asked her a question, and I told her I had heard someplace that you couldn't grow, I don't know what to call them, subterranean vegetables in an aquaponics system.
Root vegetables?
Yes, root, or yeah, like legumes.
And carrots.
Carrots or potatoes.
Yeah, well, like we've had problems growing it, but one person I know just grew some huge radishes. But we've grown radishes, and actually we've grown potatoes too. There are ways of dealing with that. There are two types of grow beds, basically. Those that use a media and those that don't. And the media is, in this case, replaces soil, and that's done with either a form of gravel or expanded clay. We prefer the expanded clay. It's much easier to work with. And what you do is you bring the water in and you flood these grow beds with this media in it and your plants in it. And then you drain it out. So you have a purging. You have a continuous exchange of water. So the roots get air and such, especially if you're doing flowering plants, the roots need air, need oxygen on the roots. So that the amount of water and the time the water is spending on the roots, we understand, has a lot to do with growing root vegetables. You need to put the water on it for a whole lot less time. So we're developing timed grow beds so we can control the time for that. And we're going to be doing experiments with it. But other people have used pots, just regular planting pots with media in it, and then trickle the water through on a time basis, and those seem to work well. But in the standard flood and drain grow beds, they seem to be a little bit problematic. That's the only plant that has special requirements other than your flowering plants, like a lot of air on the roots, and the leafy greens can be in water all the time. Now, the non-media grow beds, which have water flowing, either the bathed in water or water flowing, depending on what kind you're talking about, the leafy greens can handle water all the time on the plants. So apparently, they don't absorb very much, or don't need as much oxygen on the roots as other plants do, the flowering.
Now, one of my questions for you also is, when you guys do a lot of YouTube videos, and I've seen a bunch of them, and when I look at those, I also see on the side other YouTube videos about aquaponics. Can you tell me the difference between like buying a system such as one from Aquaponics USA versus building it yourself? I mean, I've seen people like trying to cut drums in half and trying to do it, trying to build their own aquaponics system or barrelponics or whatever they want to call it. And so I'm trying to figure out what the difference is.
Well, most people would tell you it's mainly cost. And there is truth to that. When you build it yourself, you use whatever materials you can get for free or otherwise, and you put it together, and you can do it fairly inexpensively. If you know what you're doing, it'll work fine. And that's basically the other difference that we like to express, and that is the fact that we've had several years of experience of basically we built our systems based on information that was given to us by the Australians and Murray Hallam and others over there, and there are many, many years of experience of using media field grow beds. So we started with that, and then we started experimenting. Murray once said to me, he says, go with what works and then experiment after that. And that's exactly what we did. And did a lot of experimenting with all kinds of different ratios and tried different things and different fish densities and different amounts of aeration and read and learned a lot after that about the requirements of oxygen in the water, which most people don't pay very much attention to at all. And it's really, really important. One of the key things in the system. So the answer, besides the cost, is the fact that our systems are designed, and we've improved upon them and improved upon them and improved upon them, and they work, and they always work. Now, I tell people that are new to this, if you want to become a farmer and you get a piece of land and you get a tractor, it doesn't make you a farmer. And basically that's what we're offering. We're offering the same equivalency of a tractor and a piece of land. But people still have to understand how to operate an aquaponic system. And we give a little tutorial in the back of our assembly manuals that, because our systems are broken down for shipment, where it tells them how basically the basic operation of the system. But like anything, when you're growing anything, the best fertilizer is the farmer shadow.
Okay, that's very cool. Go ahead, Colorado.
No, I was just saying, I like that. The best fertilizer is the farmer's shadow. I love it.
Now, I want to do a quick apology, Oliver. I don't know if you've listened to our show before, but I have a pet pug who's 15 years old that likes to sit on my feet when I do the radio show. And occasionally his snoring gets really loud, and I always have to warn the guests, that's not Colorado Ron or I snoring, thinking that the topic is boring. It's my 15-year-old pug that is really getting to an enjoyable deep sleep, and I can't kick him out because he won't leave. I apologize if you hear any snoring and you're like, what the heck is that?
Well, I'm not hearing it, but the listeners may.
Yeah, they may. All right, so let's take along the lines that Colorado Ron just went. You know, when you were at the show, I think you had an M20 system set up, right? It was like four little growing beds in a water tank with your stuff. And, you know,
Not at the Mesa show.
What size did you have at the Mesa show?
We had that set up at the at an LA show a couple of weeks earlier, but it was just a mock-up. It wasn't an operating system. What we had was what we call our Food Forever Growing System 20. It has two 11-square-foot grow beds that are square. They're about a 1 meter square, a little bit slightly more, and a 120-gallon round fish tank.
Okay. So
and that's our best seller, and that's a modular system because we've designed that over time to a person can purchase that system and gets everything with it that's needed to, you know, and then they can add whatever media they want or purchase from us to save money, and then they can add another module to that which connects up to that so it exchanges all the water and shares the water, which is important for stabilizing it.
Now,
and that's what we have to show.
Okay, wonderful. And I thought it was a 20. It's just you have two different types of 20s. Okay, so a system like that, theoretically, how much produce can you produce? And, you know, because that's what it always breaks down to when we get questions. It's like, okay, I've got a family of five, and I want to produce stuff all winter long. How big of a system or what do I need? And so let's just get down to brass tacks. I mean, you know, Ron's got
okay.
a family of 55. well, it just seems like every day. How is Heather, by the way?
Heather's doing well. Okay. She's out of her first trimester, whatever they call it. So okay. She's doing well.
So you know, I have five. He's got coming up on seven.
Seven. Yep.
So what do you need to sustain a family of, let's say, the average, you know, let's say five?
First, let me answer that by saying this first. The systems that we sell online currently, and this is all going to change and in the process of changing currently, are not systems that are designed to feed individuals or family without – they are just supplemental systems, meaning you can grow your leafy greens and some flowering plants and such in there to – add to your diet. They're not growing staples. That's not the way to – aquaponic systems is really not the way to grow staples because staples can be grown elsewhere and be preserved throughout the winter. And your starches, basically. So we're talking about live, healthy, organic-based food, and you can put non-GMO seeds in there, of course, which you don't want to do. And that would supplement a family with some leafy greens. Now, we have found that if you grow just, for example, you mentioned lettuce. If you grow just lettuce in the system and you plant one grow bed full of lettuce, 28 days, you know, sprouted lettuce, it's already sprouted, and you put it in there, and 28 days later you're going to have a whole grow bed full of lettuce And you're not going to be able to eat hardly a quarter of it before the rest of it bolts or spoils or whatever. So that's not what you want to do. You want to be able to square foot it and break it up and grow different things in it. So, but to get to the answer of your question, we are developing, and we have been commissioned to do this without money, by the way. But we've been commissioned to do this and have super interest from a number of people who've called us and are very serious about this, of developing a village-sized system that will feed 50 people totally from the aquaponic system. Now, in order to do that, we've had to do a lot of research on the nutrient requirements of a human in terms of the balance between the protein and the vegetables. And what we found in an aquaponic system, the amount of, in order to produce enough protein with fish to feed that many people and get their minimum daily protein requirement, we end up with four times the amount of vegetables that they need. It will produce four times the amount of vegetables they need. So this gives us the opportunity, or that those people the opportunity, either to sell the extra vegetables that they produce or grow some fish food in some of those grow beds to help for sustainability, or grow let some of the plants go to seed. I mean, there's all kinds of options there. You end up having a lot more grow bed space and vegetables than you need. So the Achilles heel, so to speak, here in terms of quantity is the amount of protein that can be grown in the tanks. That's the limiting factor. So that requires about 2,400. So you figure about 25 square foot per person if you have a large-scale system, but you can't break that down to a small-scale system because there's economies of scale here.
So 25 square feet per person, is that what it comes out to?
Right, 25 square feet per person, if you have a large enough system, because not all that 25 square feet, if you have a 25 square foot system and you harvest some things out of it, you always have some empty grow beds or grow beds with small plants in them that are not optimally grown. Now, if you do a lot of transplanting and such, you can optimize that. But that tends to be a number that's kind of thrown about, and I don't know how accurate that number is, but it's a number that we're using.
Okay. So for like a family, say, of five, then you would need roughly 250 to, let's say, 500 square feet to
somewhere in that range, right. And okay. That would need to be under glass.
Under glass.
Because of climate and winter and seasons. And you're talking year-round. Remember, aquaponics is a year-round growing system. It has to be because it takes sometimes that long for the fish to grow out.
I just love this concept. Obviously, of course, the next thing would be that what I wanted to do for my personal backyard is to build the greenhouse and then, you know, set up the aquaponic system in there. And I've kind of gotten in a rush, and I thought about putting it into I've got also a heated garage. So I thought about setting it up in there just because I'm getting antsy, so to speak, I guess. I'm kind of getting tired of waiting on the greenhouse. And so I thought about just setting it up in there and putting it under fluorescent lights.
Well, here's what we've learned on that. We built a greenhouse. Again, we're at 3,500 square feet. It gets down December, January at night around 28 degrees on average, sometimes colder. 95 degrees in the summer, sometimes warmer. This glass or polycarbonate or whatever you're using, plastic, whatever, to cover the greenhouse is thermally transparent. A lot of heat comes in the summer and a lot of cold heat goes out in the wintertime. So you end up having to heat and cool it. And anytime you try to heat and cool something that has about an R0 for insulation, it takes a lot of energy to heat and cool it. If you have a large swing in temperature, remember you have about a 30-degree rise in there. So certain times of the year and day, it's fine. Other times, it's not. So our energy costs were so high in heating and cooling this greenhouse that we decided to build what we call a grow room using that back porch, using it, just walled it in. It's pretty much the same square footage as the greenhouse, almost exactly the same shape and size. And we built a whole aquaponic system indoors, and insulated, and it takes considerably less energy, maybe a tenth as much to heat and cool it. But it requires grow lights, which are energy consumers. So you know, we didn't really gain anything by doing that. But we did learn about indoor growing, and what we tried all different kinds of grow lights. We spent thousands of dollars on LED grow lights. They're now not being used. We found that fluorescents were going to grow leafy greens in there, and that's it. If we were going to grow, seriously wanted to grow some multiple flowering plants, we would go with that. We would go with halides and high-pressure sodiums in there. And all these lights are about the same efficiency. Fluorescents run about 80 lumens per watt. Halides run anywhere from 80 to 100 or better. So they're all pretty close to the same efficiency. All they produce the same amount of heat. The amount of electricity you put in is the amount of heat you get out, regardless of the efficiency of the light, because ultimately through entropy everything goes to heat. So we've learned that we can do this, but it's always energy requirement, has energy requirements.
Hmm. Now, let's see. So, yeah, well, you obviously have a certain amount of energy because, you, like I said, you're either heating or cooling the greenhouse, or you are using lights, but you also have the pumps in the systems
pumps
as well.
Use very little, pumps use very little energy.
Do they? Okay.
Our 20 system has a single submersible water pump that's adequate and to do everything it's doing. It has, it's a little bit oversized, giving not so much for the volume flow, but for the pressure, so people can, and has add on spigots, so people can add on towers or other things external in towers. You know, you need to pump the water up to a certain level, so there's enough pressure there to go up to about 10 feet or so. That's why we oversized the pump a little bit. And then there's an air pump that's adequate to put lots of oxygen in the tank, and we run a lot of air in the tank. In the fish tank, we used to aerate the grow beds, but we found it's more efficient just to add more air to the fish tank, and then just move the water in and out of the grow beds and rapidly cycle the grow beds. And in, the whole system runs 58 watts.
Okay.
I have a question. So, looking at the system and remembering it there, how much maintenance is involved, you know, monthly and annually to keep these things running, and like what? How much has to be replaced? I mean, outside obviously the vegetation and the fish. I mean, but what kind of maintenance has to be done to the actual system?
System maintenance generally requires purging the lines on a weekly basis, meaning that the lines feeding the water being pumped up to the grow beds, because it's pumped up and gravity flow back to the fish tank, accumulates fish solids in it, and on a weekly basis, because you don't have a high flow rate. You have a very slow flow rate into the grow beds, and in order to have them cycle, have a cycle timing right on them, and that the lines tend, the fish solids are heavier than water, and they tend to accumulate in the lines. And so once a week you go and you open the lines up and you blow them out for about 30 seconds, and then you throttle back to where you need them to be to flood and drain at the right speed. The other thing you need to do, and that's about it, you need to keep the pump clean, because the little veins, little slits in it that where the water goes in will start accumulating fish solids on it, and you need to keep that clean. Occasionally you need to take the pump out once a month or every 2 or 3 months or so, and just pull the cap off and clean it out inside, which takes just a couple of minutes. It's nothing, it's really simple. And then put it back in and turn it back on, and away you go. The other thing you need to do is that if you're growing, this is where the farmer comes in. You need to monitor your chemistry of your water. And initially you need to monitor it daily when you're first starting the system up until the system gets what's called cycled after a couple of weeks. And then you can start backing off, and you'll see there's not any changes, and then you just take it less off and less off. And once a week we recommend, once the system gets up and running and the fish start growing. But you do need to keep an eye on that and know what to do in case things get a little bit out of whack. The other thing you need to do is that if you plant flowering plants too soon, like tomatoes, and they start growing and they start pulling a lot of nitrates from the water, and when they flower, they pull tremendous amounts of nitrates from the water, and your nitrate count in your water can go below a level that is necessary for good, healthy growth. And plants are coded in their DNA to say, if I don't see nitrates, enough nitrates, am I getting enough, I'm going to grow roots. I'm going to stop growing above the ground. I'm going to put down more roots. Now, I've seen a lot of pictures of people growing lettuce in the water. And you pick up the little foam boards or whatever, and you see these foot-long lettuce roots. I can tell you right now, if they have foot-long lettuce roots, their nitrate count is way too low. When our nitrate count is where it needs to be, and we pull up the lettuce root ball is about the size of a golf ball to a baseball. That's it. That's all it needs. It only grows what roots it needs. It has plenty of nutrients coming in the roots, not just nitrates, but other nutrients. The other thing a lot of other people do is they remove the fish solids because they don't want to deal with them. So all they have now is the ammonia. And the ammonia gets converted into nitrate. That's like me saying, I'm going to grow lettuce alone, and that's all you can eat. And or like staples, it's the only thing you're going to eat. Well, the plants, you know, need nitrates, but they need other things too. And that's the fish solids is what break down through a process called mineralization. And this is done by a bacteria called heterotrophic, that break down the fish solids from a suspended solid to a dissolved solid so that the plants can uptake them. And what you feed your fish is what you feed your plants. So all that nutrients and minerals and everything that's in the fish food, eventually, or much of it, makes its way to the plants through this natural process in the friendly bacteria, the probiotic of the system, breaking all this down and giving it to plants. If you remove it, it retards the growth of the plant. And the plants are not as tasty. They just don't do as well because they don't have the proper nutrients.
Now, I have a question real quick. And here it's me with my fear-mongering. So I want to – you're the perfect person to ask for this because you can dispel this myth. Now, when I was in the service and I was spending a lot of time in Central and South America, a lot of the guys, including myself, got dysentery because we'd get melons, watermelons and you know, cantaloupe and whatever from the local village, and the water had dysentery in it, and we found out later that although we didn't drink the water, the dysentery and different diseases and things could be picked up by the watermelon and be transferred. Is there any kind of diseases or anything that people would have to be worried about and monitor in an aquaponic system, or you know, will that stuff transfer at all, like taste? You know, from the water?
Well, of course, you want to put – what you put in is what you get out. You want to put filtered water, high-quality filtered water in it. A lot of people talk about using UV filters in their system, and I said, well, if you want to kill your bacteria, go ahead and use a UV filter. And other people say – they argue about that, and I said, well, if it's not killing your bacteria, then why bother having it in there? So you don't want to do that, but you want to put in – you want to put in filtered water. What we have here – we use town water, so we run it through a very large carbon filter right off the bat. We sediment filter, carbon filter, and then we run it through a UV filter. This is the incoming water to the system, not the system itself, but any new water that's being added to the system. So all the or most of the bacteria that's in the water is DOA before it gets in. And then we run it through a catalytic carbon filter. That's just in case the other carbon filter gets eventually gets spent, and it's at that point right now. A catalytic carbon filter removes chlorine, chloramines, and heavy metals, but not, I have found nothing about removing fluorides. So now the water coming in is very clean. The only other thing you're going to be putting in there is you're going to be putting two other things. One is plants, and you never want to get plants that are soil-based and put them in there unless you take them off and wash the roots really, really careful. And get all the soil and any pathogens in the soil off of them before planting them in an aquaponics grow bed. We prefer to go from seed. We always recommend people going from seed and using heirloom seeds. The other thing you're going to be putting in is fish food that can contain some bad things. So you want to get fish food that doesn't have any terrestrial animals in it that are used for protein, like dead cows or whatever. And that's the food that we provide here for people, and we use. When the fish are young, the tilapia, they need a very high protein base because they're growing so fast. They're basically omnivores and cannibals actually too if you're not careful. And they will eat the young, they'll eat the babies if you don't separate them out. And this is a reason you want to have multiple fish tanks for multiple grow-outs because different size of fish require different fish food. The young ones up to a few inches long require about 50% protein. And this protein is unfortunately gotten from ocean fish. So no terrestrial animals, and then once they get up to 4 or 5 inches, you can switch them off to about 30% protein. And at that point, you can go to a vegetarian diet if you want, and grow them out on a non-GMO vegetarian diet, which we have that food available too. But when they're young, they really need the high protein. And there are other ways of giving them protein through black soldier fly larvae is a really good quality thing, duckweed, things like that. So, but you have to be careful what you put in your system. Another thing we've learned recently is that from a place called Reba Farms in Arizona, we toured that the day after the expo there in Chandler, right out next to Mesa, you know, just a mile down the road, is they discovered this white spotted problems on the plants. And they did a lot of research, and they finally found that they had people who were smokers, tobacco smokers, and working in the grow rooms. What happens is tobacco has this disease on it. People smoke the tobacco, that disease gets in their lungs, and they go in, even though they're not smoking in the greenhouses, they go in there and breathe this out, and it gets on the plants. So they had to stop employing any smokers and working in their greenhouses at all, and that problem went away. So there's another thing that was we were glad to learn, because we have had that problem, and one of our workers is a smoker, so we will have to deal with that in the future.
Just an alert here: the tobacco industry denies any part in putting white spots on plants.
Yeah, well, of course they would. But, I, again, I'm just telling you what they told us and what they discovered. I don't know that that's true or not. I'll just take their word for it. And they solved their problem by doing that.
You know, that's interesting. You know, so going back, though, now, you have several different systems, but you said you're also coming out with something, you know, some newer type systems, which was to feed a village. Do you have any kind of timeline on something like that, what it would take to...
We've been taking our time because it's a costly thing, but we've had such tremendous interest from serious people. In every case, they wanted us to build these in third world countries, or at least in the most recent case, overseas, to be able to feed children in schools and such. And in the last few weeks, we've had several calls on this, serious calls. And... most recently, the person's given us a deadline that we need sometime in January to have. What we're doing is we're building a 1/10 scale version of the smallest farm, and we're calling it our micro farm. So we're converting everything we have here to that new system, which means we're completely changing everything out. And the trick is we have live fish that we have to deal with. If we didn't have any fish or anything, we could just tear everything out and build it and then put everything back, start over again. But we have to move things slowly and transfer, and it's a little tricky and keep still going and plants. For example, we planned to do that to our grow room first. We stopped planting, took all the plants out, and then we got delayed a month, and so there were no plants in the grow room for a month, and the nitrates got so high it started killing the fish. So we had to do a water exchange, and we've had some problems in there. So we had to go ahead and plant some plants back in existing grow room grow beds in order to absorb the nitrates, so they're just barely moving along here. And light it all back up again, and then really then move along. And then we had this one fellow recently come along and say, no, I really want you to, I want to do this. And he called back the next day, I've got the land, I'm ready to go, let's go. I've called my people overseas, we've got the place, we want to put it, we want to do this, I'll pay for it. And he was really serious, I could tell. This guy was really serious. And he was pushing us. I want it by January. I want to come spend a week with you. We're going to show me how to do this. We're going to do this. We're going to go off and do this. And so now we're like, okay, got the message. So our push is to get the micro farm up and running in the next month, which is going to take a lot of work because we're getting a lot of orders and we're building a lot of systems. And I'm going to have to hire some more workers, it looks like, to do this. And that's difficult because that means I have to manage them, and you know what that's about. If you're to manage people.
I understand.
You have to stand there and show them this and this and this, and it just takes a lot of time.
Yeah, I understand completely. Now, if you do need a test model for that micro village. You just let me know.
we're definitely doing it. We've already identified the components and started purchasing it. It's got to be an automated system. And the reason we're going to automation, I know a 10 man of one of the Hawaiian fellows there says, oh, you want to go third world, you don't want to do high tech, you want to do low tech. And I'm looking at all this going, no, actually, that's an interesting concept, but in order to make this work, I have to put some technology into it. So it has to, it has controllers and timers and flow situations in order to optimize this. There's really no way around it.
You know, that's
if you really
amazing.
You want to feed people fish and vegetables, everything has to be really optimized, and the only way to do this is through some automation.
Do you have any idea? I'm sure you've got rough draft, but do you have any idea what a system like that would run?
No.
Okay.
I really don't.
Okay.
I have no idea at all.
I was just thinking, you know, that's a great idea for schools. You mentioned schools in third world countries and things like that and feed the kids. But I was thinking, you know, heck, why in the world aren't our schools doing that here? I mean, that would be...
you ever heard of Jamie Oliver?
I have not.
Oh, Jamie Oliver. Oh, Food Revolution?
He had a series on.
He went to the schools and started, I think, in Virginia. Had some success there. Some success there in not growing the food, but bringing in good quality food instead of the government food, the frozen junky food that didn't have any nutrients in it.
Right.
And with getting obesity was a huge problem. Obesity and diabetes. So he brought in into this. You know, it's a political struggle, but he had pretty good luck there. Then he went to Los Angeles. And ended up having a total head-on collision, which ended the series. I mean, they kicked him out of the school right in the middle of trying to do the series, so that ended the series on TV.
Wow.
They kicked him out. But then the fellow who was in charge of all of that in Los Angeles apparently got voted out by the board or something, and they had a new fellow come in at the very end who says, no, I'm all for doing this, and that was the last show, as I recall. I haven't heard any more of that, maybe not. But you're dealing with a huge government bureaucracy here, and there's a lot of people who have vested interest in the status quo. What can I say?
No,
read between the lines on that.
Oh yeah, no, I agree. But we just got an announcement here that all the teachers in one of the schools they got iPads for all the teachers. I thought, well, heck, instead of spending that money on iPads, why don't they spend that money and build an aquaponics system? That would be much cooler.
We are putting aquaponic systems in a lot of the schools, but these are basically for training, and then I don't see any of the food coming out of that going into the school cafeteria. I'd like to see some of the food coming out, but that's a huge uphill battle, because then you're getting into local and state and regulations about food that you're being, what I'm saying? It's government all over the place to, quote, keep people safe. So they keep people safe by denying them food. Well, we don't certify your food, so you're going to have to go hungry today.
Yeah. And on top of that, there's we've become such a litigious country. You'd have to. I think everybody'd be overly paranoid that one kid would get sick and it would have nothing to do with the food, and they'd sue the school and everybody else that's attached to it.
Exactly.
It's sad that you can't help anybody out anymore because you have to worry about getting sued.
Well, that's why third world countries are, except for the politics, and there's politics everywhere. So they definitely have to have an in with the government and have the blessing that we're not going to run into any huge battles with them and have them actually – we really want the local government, at whatever level that is, to invite us in and ask us to come in. And we can get funding. There's a lot of money out there to do this from a lot of different organizations. But you have to have two things. One, you have to have the system, and you have to have the government cooperation, local, usually local. Unlike here, where the federal government's intrusive and everything, local doesn't cut it because there's overriding rules at higher levels of government, state, county, state, federal, whatever. And because the federal government is funding a lot of these things, that gives them power. and everybody bows to their will because of the money. So they're you know, that's how that game is played.
All right. Well, we have about 5 minutes left, Oliver. So I have to get one last thing in before we sign off here, and that's you kind of hinted at it earlier, but didn't quite go there. So, Biopod. So can you tell us a little? When we were at the event.
Hey, Ron, when are you going to get your Biopod? You were fighting for it.
I know. Do you have some more?
Oh, sure. Just go on the website.
I'm glad to get it now.
Whole page dedicated to it. The Biopod.
I thought that was your last one. That's why I let Bubba have it.
Well, no. That was just one we brought to the show.
Ah.
So what they're talking about, folks, is there's a device, and if you go to the website, aquaponicsusa.com, and at the top there'll be a button there for Biopods. He mentioned the soldier fly earlier, which creates which has a larvae, which you can feed to not only the tilapia, but I'm actually starting to do it to throw them to my chickens. And these things are like almost pure protein, and they're just it's amazing what they can consume. Can you tell us a little bit about the Biopod and how that works?
Yeah, let me give you a quick here on the black soldier fly. The black soldier fly is not like the house fly. They don't spread disease. They don't even have a mouth. They don't eat. They grow as a larvae. They hatch into a fly. They live 2, 3, 4 days maybe at max. All they do is breed and lay eggs. And they always lay eggs in some kind of a composted, decaying organic matter. So instead of bacteria breaking this compost down into its component parts, it goes the other direction. The little eggs hatch. The black soldier fly larvae consume that waste and grow, produce their own waste. But for the most part, they grow and they produce about 50 to 60% protein larvae by dry weight. And they are very nutritious food and for fish and chickens and such. Like one fellow says, the heck with a catcher pod, I'm going to leave that off and just let them fall on the ground and let the chickens pick them up. So that's what he's doing. You can take these larvae, the Biopod actually is designed to capture the larvae. They migrate away from the food up a ramp and then fall into a catch basin. And then they... you can take those and feed them directly to the fish. You can grab them and you can freeze them and then feed them later, so they're preservable, and they're a great source. And the Biopod itself, the small one we sell, will supposedly convert about 5 pounds of composted waste a day. If you have enough black soldier fly larvae, and you need to have an environment where you have black soldier flies. We don't here, as it turns out. Because we get too cold in the winter.
But I'm just amazed at how much material they can eat. You have a video online, and the first time I saw that video of them devouring a fish, I was just floored.
Yeah, that was a 24-hour video, I believe, and there was two fairly large fish in there that were dead. They put in there, and the time-lapse photography. Within 2 days, all there was a whole lot of black flies, a whole lot of larvae, and two skeletons. And that was it.
Wow.
They consumed those fish.
What is your YouTube channel page?
What's that?
What is the YouTube channel for your company?
Our YouTube channel, when you go to YouTube, just put Aquaponics Space USA Space TV.
Okay.
You may not even get that far. Aquaponics USA, and then we have a YouTube channel.
All right. Well, Oliver, this is a lot of great information. Before we go, can you tell anybody about, you know, Christmas is right around the corner. When this show airs, we're right about 2 weeks away. We keep telling everybody prepping things are great Christmas gifts because you're preparing the whole family. Are there any great deals or anything you want to suggest from Aquaponics USA for
Well, we have the Biopod is one for feeding your farm animal or your chickens and fish and such. We have the systems online. The systems are built to order, so if you order now, we might be able to get it to them by Christmas, but that's going to be a little bit of a push because we're kind of back-ordered right now. We've got a lot of orders we're filling. So these things take time to build. We try to catch up and get ahead on them, but as soon as we start, then the orders came in. So we're kind of maxed out here right now, but we can have some out within a few weeks to you. So that's kind of where we are right now. We are mini modules, the mini systems we're changing. We're going to be changing those pretty soon, and coming up we're going to be adding some new modules in here in the next few weeks. So for people who have limited space. And our indoor system, our single indoor system, which is the plug and grow, has a, it's a small 2x3 foot square, 2.5x3 foot square system. It's about 5 feet tall. It has everything in it you need. It's got everything in it. And all you do is get some fish and put in it, water fish, and plant some seeds, and you're ready to go. And you can have your herbs and herbs and green leafies right there in your kitchen and dining room. Ours is in our dining room, and it works great.
Okay,
and it has a clear tank, so you can see the fish.
Good. Now, can you give us your website and give us your Facebook page or anything that you have so that people can look you up?
It's aquaponics. www.aquaponicsusa.com, and the Facebook page is Aquaponics USA.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us. Again, people, go to aquaponicsusa.com. It's a fantastic site. Lots of videos, lots of good information. And if you're
there's a link to the Facebook page on there at the very bottom of the homepage.
Ah, okay, great.
That's the best way to get there because there's a number of Aquaponics USA space capital that have started up. So. That's the link. We'll get you the right one. And their blog, and we have lots of articles and such on there.
Yeah, lots and lots of good information, folks. I can't.
Yeah, over 40 pages of information on that website.
Great. All right. Well, Oliver, thank you very much, and we hope you have a Merry Christmas.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. Scott, Ron, I appreciate the call.
All right.
Merry Christmas to you.
All right. Take care.
Take care.
Bud Light presents Real Men of Genius.
Real Men of Genius.
Today we salute you, Mr. All-You-Can-Eat Buffet Inventor.
Mr. All-You-Can-Eat Buffet Inventor.
You've given us the real American dream. A tray, 15 feet of food, and a little sign that says, "Go nuts, buddy."
Pinch me, I'm dreaming.
Pushing side dish innovation to its limits, you offer creamed everything and 400 flavors of gelatin.
Feed it frenzy.
If there's beef, you'll chip it. If there's chicken, you'll fry it. And if there's gravy, well, then everything's going to be okay.
Thank God for the gravy.
So crack open a nice cold Bud Light, buffet boy. You know the way to a man's heart and a few hundred tasty ways to challenge it.
Mr. All-You-Can-Eat Buffet Inventor.
Bud Light Beer, Anheuser-Busch, Fort Collins, Colorado.
All right, Colorado, we're back from Real Men of Genius.
Those guys are crazy. Love it.
Let me tell you, those guys are very creative. I don't know where they came up with some of these, but, man, I sit here and just crack up the entire time.
I have no idea where they come up with this stuff. It's crazy. It's so funny.
Yeah. All right. Well, so this is the end of the show, guys. It was a very long show. We had great guests on. We'd like to thank Dave Duffy from Backwoods Home Magazine and Oliver Duffy, no relation, from the
Aquaponics USA.
Aquaponics USA, yep. And as Dave Duffy mentioned, you can click on the link that will be on our Facebook page and on the Blog Talk Radio information at the bottom, and you
yep.
can get a one-year subscription for $24.95. And Dave will also throw in his book, Can America Be Saved from Stupid People, signed by Dave Duffy. He's going to sign every copy so you can either give it away for Christmas or hang it up on your shelf or do whatever you want to do as part of that. So, hey, look, guys. If you like the radio show, if you like the magazine, keep supporting it. Get a subscription. It's a great way to do things. Subscribe on the Kindle, although we get no credit for the Kindle. But still, we're here to support Dave and Backwoods Home Magazine and all the people out there on the Oregon coast.
That's right. That's right.
Okay, so let's wrap this puppy up. Colorado, why don't you give the website for Self-Reliance Expo and how to get a hold of you on Facebook and how to check out Self-Reliance Expo on Facebook.
Okay, yep. You can find us at selfreliancexpo.com. You can also find our Facebook page at facebook.com/selfreliancexpo. And you can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/ColoradoRon page.
Now, if you want Backwoods Home Magazine, you can go to www.backwoodshome.com. You could go to Backwoods Home Mag on Facebook or Bubba Da Vinci on Facebook to check out what I'm doing. That's it for this week. Next week we will have another show for you with another special vendor guest and another guest from Backwoods Home Magazine. You have a good weekend, Colorado.
Sounds good. Take care, guys.
California and South Alabama and little towns all around this land. We can skin a buck and run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive.